Welcome back, everybody. This is Oscar Talk with Chris Tapley of InContention.com and Ann Thompson of Thompson on Hollywood. We were just talking about how tired we are, and not that you want to hear about that, but there's a lot going on lately. First of all, last weekend was the first kind of big Academy hurrah of the season, the Governor's Awards, and Ann was on hand, so how about you tell us about your experience there?
Well, when I first walked in, it was at the Kodak. It's in the Hollywood and Highland complex, and it was really star-studded. I mean, when I first walked in, there was Elle Fanning and Stephen Dorff from somewhere, you know, posing for the cameras, and there was a whole Coppola group, you know, Robert Duvall, James Caan, George Lucas, Frances Eleanor. They were talking to Peter Fonda. You know, Clint Eastwood was coming in with his wife Dina, and then there was a whole cocktail party, and you know, you just saw everybody who was anybody, you know, chairman of Fox, Jim Giannopoulos, you know, Natalie Portman, you know, from Black Swan, Darren Aronofsky, all the folks from Fox Searchlight. You know, you just sort of walked your way through, and there was the chairman of you know, Disney, Rich Ross, talking about how he's going to put a big campaign behind Secretariat and so forth. And, you know, you just wandered through, and, you know, I was hanging out with Juliette Lewis and asking her about her accident that she had after my sneak previews class, and she's okay. She just had some whiplash, you know, and you know, you're just, you know, there was an enormous presence from all the different Oscar contenders. So you had, you know, the table for Tom Hooper and King's Speech, and you had the Blue Valentine table, and Ryan Gosling was there. You had the beautiful table with Iñárritu, which was right next to mine. He was with Gustavo Santaolalla, or however you pronounce that.
Santaolalla.
Thank you. You must have studied Spanish.
I could be actually saying it wrong. Who knows?
That's close, because Iñárritu was trying to tell me how to say it, and I was really like flopping over my tongue. He's amazing because he won Oscars not only for Brokeback Mountain but for Babel. You know, so so he's sort of cool. And then and there was just an extraordinary. You know, there was Annette Bening and Warren Beatty, and there was, you know, Robert Duvall was there for Get Low, and I was a little surprised that when they finally at the end of the evening got to the big Thalberg Award going to Coppola, and he was sitting at the big center long table. Last year it had been all the Roger Corman directors, you know, honoring Roger. Right. And Roger was there this year. He was sitting at the Coppola table. But and Sophia and Roman did the introduction to their father, and but they're neither of them very charismatic, really, as presenters. You know, they always act as though they're sort of going through the, when they have to perform in public, they're sort of going through the motions of something that they don't really want to do. At least that's how I read it. But I was surprised that they didn't use Duvall and Caan, you know, as long as they were there. You know, there was a slightly, I mean, for all the star-studdedness and for all the wattage that was in the room, and this is an event that isn't televised, what they do is they actually take video, which is great. It's all online. It's all at Oscars.org, and you can see the video from all the presentations and acceptance speeches and everything. And the Godard one was really interesting because you could feel the chill in the room because they felt very defensive. The people who were from the Board of Governors, and you definitely got a sense that the Board of Governors now, the Academy, is much more of a boomer, baby boomer age, you know, and that's how they grew up with Godard. Godard was this extraordinary influence on them, and the people who spoke, Lynn Littman, Phil Robinson, you sensed that Hal Wexler, you just sensed who worked with Godard. You have this extraordinary sense of how big a deal he was to them, and as well he should have been, and their right to give it to him.
Right.
But there was so much controversy around it that everybody was sort of, this is why we're doing this, you know, this is why it's a good idea. And and then when you get to Kevin Brownlow, the wonderful documentarian and historian and scholar who wrote the must-read book, The Parade's Gone By, about the silent era, it was a little dull, you know. Mm-hmm. There's not much you can do there. That just isn't, just in terms of an event that was entertaining and enlightening at the same time, which the first one was.
Yeah, well, I guess if it was like a televised thing, they would have tried to get, say, Duvall and company involved with a Godfather kind of thing going on. But it seems to me like it's become this, or it's only the second year, but from my perch, it just kind of looks like this intimate thing that everyone's content for it to be, not very fussy. Does that seem to be the case?
The first time it just had this extraordinary bonhomie, you know, this great sense of love and honor, and like the Eli Wallach event. Of a part of this was the one that captured what I think it's supposed to be, mm-hmm. where you feel this great love and this great affection, and everybody's genuinely, you know, committed and honoring this person, and who was just so obviously extraordinary. And Jackson was there, and Tony Bennett sang to them, and you know they were clearly good, dear friends, and there was real love in the room, and you just felt it.
That was early, right? That was like the first thing.
Yeah. Well, the first thing was the Godard.
Okay.
And then Eli Wallach. So it peaked there.
Right.
And then it was sort of downhill from there. I think there were various factors that sort of contributed to this being less, you know, huge than the first one. And I think they could easily reclaim it. You know, it was lovely. It was wonderful. I'm not complaining. I was lucky to be there.
Well, very cool. I might go next year. Sounds like a fun time.
You should. You should.
Well, this week we had two shortlists come from the Academy for animated features and for documentaries. Firstly, the animated features, only 15 qualified, so that means there'll be only 3 nominees.
That's tough.
Arbitrary.
It's tough on the ones that are going to have to be left out as a result. I think it's really unfortunate.
Yeah, well, of the 16 that submitted, Yogi Bear was the one that did not qualify. I'm just surprised no one tried to pick up this movie Chico and Rita and qualify it, because it's a potential nominee in my eyes. It's like I said it after I saw it at Telluride, but it's like a Sony Classics kind of thing to me. But anyway, we've got these 15 films, and the one that no one was expecting was something called The Dreams of Jinsha, if I'm even saying that correctly.
And I've already been invited to see it. I can't wait.
It actually opens at the Music Hall in like a week or two. That'll be its qualifying run. I might try to catch it there.
Yeah. No, I'm looking forward to that. I mean, last year it was interesting when the history of Kells, or whatever. Am I getting that wrong?
Secret of Kells.
Yeah. Thank you. That makes more sense. come to see the history of the Kells. that was a lovely movie. That was a real revelation. Yeah.
Yeah. I saw the My Dog Tulip recently.
I haven't seen that yet.
It's very,
some people are advocating that.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, it's the last screen appearance, so to speak, of Lynn Redgrave. The movie's dedicated to her. Chris Plummer narrates it. It's based on a memoir. I forget who wrote the memoir, about a man and his dog and his German Shepherd. It's very mundane, but it's very interesting, and the animation is crude, but kind of endearingly crude. So,
I want to see it very much, but I mean, you and I already argued about this. I mean, I do think it's probably between Despicable Me and The Illusionist, don't you? For the third slot?
I think it's between Tangled and The Illusionist.
Assuming that obviously Toy Story 3 and How to Train Your Dragon are locks for the first two.
Although I'd love to see Bill Plimpton be in an Oscar race. He's got
he deserves it.
Yeah,
my God.
He's got this movie Idiots and Angels, which I actually had a screener for like 2 years ago, and I've been trying to find it. I don't know where it is. But that'd be great if he could be in a race. But I think it's going to be, I think it's between The Illusionist and Tangled, actually, but probably going to be The Illusionist. Although that's what I mean. You know, who knows? You know, I think we can safely assume How to Train Your Dragon and Toy Story 3 are in there, but stuff like Shrek's not going to happen. Tinkerbell's not going to happen.
Or Megamind. Megamind's
probably not going to happen. Yeah. Legend of the Guardians is an interesting spoiler possibility. I haven't seen all the other stuff. As long as it's not Cats and Dogs, The Revenge of Kitty Galore, I think we're all okay.
Now, the dock race is really interesting because, you know, I was sort of gratified because so many of the front runners that I had, you know, it's not rocket science, you know, the ones that I had thought would be in there are in there. But there were some interesting, and we're talking, I mean, I assume you would agree that Waiting for Superman and Inside Job and Client 9would be, you know, the top contenders in this category for the final five.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the list now. I've seen Client 9. I've seen Inside Job, The Lottery. I have Precious Life. I have Tillman's Story.
I've seen The Tillman Story, which is very, very good, and it's an unusual movie because you think it's about a war scandal controversy, and it's actually about a family.
Right.
So it's really cool for that
reason. I've just been waiting. You know, I usually wait till it gets kind of thinned out like this.
Yeah, that's smart.
I have Restrepo also.
It's fabulous, just extraordinary. Yeah, that could be a front runner as well. Although there are reasons why it may not be. Mm-hmm. I was surprised, you know, I wasn't positive it would get into the top 15 because there's a lot of people who are applying sort of more conventional narrative structure and points of view questions to that movie. Mm-hmm. It has no narrative structure and it has no point of view. Mm-hmm. It's just an embedded thing. And I don't mean to put that down. I think it's brilliant for that reason.
It's just not what they respond to generally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
also, those guys are somewhat outsiders in this
right.
world. And, of course, the ultimate outsider is Banksy.
Yeah, I need to see that one. Yeah.
I have that on my pile. I will definitely – I've been wanting to see that for a long time. I have every intention of seeing it.
Yeah, and I actually just talked to Charles Ferguson earlier this week, finally.
He's really sharp.
Yeah, he is. It's intimidating to talk to him.
Indeed.
But I like him, and I'm glad the movie. I mean, I would say that is the front runner.
I agree.
In the field.
I would agree. I would hope that would be the winner.
Yeah.
So. And he got nominated last time for the Iraq film that he did.
Yeah, I told him it's like you and Alex are going to be head to head again, and you know they're friends, and
Alex have helped him.
He quite likes Client 9, and
yeah.
And,
I helped him on the first film.
Mm-hmm.
The other, it was interesting that Alex, of course, Mr. Prolific, has several movies, you know, so his Casino Jack, The United States of Money did not get in, and then there's nor did the omnibus film Freakonomics, but Lucy Walker's Countdown to Zero. Now that surprised me that it didn't get in, but the one that did was also hers, Wasteland.
Right.
So, presumably they decided not to put two films from single filmmakers on this list.
And I guess two of the others that stood out as being snubbed were Joan Rivers' Piece of Work.
Yes.
Which is...
which I loved.
Which I have on my stack also. And
that's worth seeing, you know.
Yeah, I want to see it. Yeah.
The thing about Joan Rivers is that it's a showbiz documentary, and they do tend to be... you have to... It's rare that those get through.
About someone who's essentially made a mockery of the Oscars.
Well, I'm not sure the documentary branch cares about that.
Mm-hmm.
But clearly they didn't take this as seriously as I did as a piece of documentary filmmaking. I just thought it was mm-hmm. extraordinary.
I think the big snub is Catfish. I think it's one of the best movies of the year.
I think that's a question of the documentary branch questioning its... they seem to have accepted Exit through the gift shop.
You're saying accepting its legitimacy as a work of nonfiction, right?
Correct.
I just think that is nonsense. At this point, it should be taken at face value. I mean, it's a documentary. It hasn't been disproven.
I'm not saying whether it should or it shouldn't. They didn't.
No, I know. I'm chastising them, Anne, not you. It's your fault, Anne. No, I just think that it should be taken at face value, and it's one of the best movies of the year, and it's unfortunate. But I think we probably could have seen that coming too.
Yeah. No. The question was, whether Gift Shop would make it really. And then this movie Marwan Call, which everybody raved about. I talked to the filmmakers at one point, and they sort of looked me in the eye and said, "It's not worth it to us to even submit the movie. We don't have a budget for competing. You know, it's impossible to do this for us." And that's that.
Yeah, fuck
it. They didn't.
Who cares?
So that's interesting.
Who told me about that? It was at the How to Train Your Dragon party. When I first heard about Marwan Call, and I'm still dying to see it.
Me too.
It was America Ferrera's husband told me about that movie. The guy that directed The Dry Land.
Right. I don't remember his name though.
Yeah. So I've been wanting to see that for a long time. I think that's playing over at the New Art right now. But anyway, yeah, that's the documentary field. So we'll see how that gets narrowed down in the future. It's been a busy week. Things going on in town. They're bringing the Kids Are All Right crew back around for stuff, and they had this luncheon earlier this week. I skipped it, but you were there. So you want to talk about that?
Yeah, it was a pleasant restaurant called Eva on Beverly. Mm-hmm. And it was several tables, and I sat at the Mark Ruffalo. The actors were sort of moving around, but I sat with Mark Ruffalo, who I didn't realize lived in upstate New York, and sort of like his character in the movie, he's very interested in sustainable agriculture and you know, talking about what you can eat in different, you know, people were talking, it was just like hanging out and having a great conversation. We did get into this wonderful story about how when he showed up at Comic-Con for the big Avengers presentation, I remember noticing and writing when I covered it that he looked a little bit like a deer in the headlights up there on the stage. And, you know, a lot of people hadn't known whether or not he was getting that part and as the Hulk. And what happened is that he was home in Los Angeles. I guess, where was he? I guess he was, you know, sleeping in his hotel or something in Los Angeles. And he was told the night before that if a car turned up in front of his door at 4 a.m., he was going to Comic-Con. It meant that he had the part.
Oh, that's bizarre. I don't remember reading that.
Yeah, it meant that he actually had gotten the part. And he actually, you know, literally had to get dressed and get his bag and get down there and get in the car and go to Comic-Con and be backstage. And everybody was like, you know, saying, you know, we want Edward Norton, you know, and mm-hmm. he had to come out. So that was why he was so nonplussed.
Interesting.
And he's still preparing for that part. He, you know, they haven't started to shoot that. They're still writing it and getting mm-hmm. it together.
And the other thing was Summit Entertainment had their
Yeah, that's true. But the rest of the you know, that Lisa Cholodenko and Julianne were at this thing also. And one of the things that struck me about my conversation with Lisa, reminded yet again of how very smart she is, needless to say. But she really is open for business, she said, in terms of looking at people, you know, being a director for hire. You know, she would work on a script if someone else had written it. It would have to be something she was compatible with. But the whole, there's been a big debate about Darren Aronofsky and Lisa Cholodenko, sort of, you know, the idea that you would sell out, you know, that you would give up your indie cred and go Hollywood and everything. And one of the things,
the realities of the business these days, really.
Yes. If you've got heat and you've got some wind behind you, go for it, man,
yeah.
Because it doesn't happen again necessarily. And there's momentum and you ride it. And if Darren wants to make an overall deal at Fox and do Wolverine and work with his old buddy, Hugh Jackman from The Fountain, go for it. You know, he went through hell on his last two movies. It was really grim for him, actually, getting those movies made. And I all power to him.
And you kind of see this exodus to television going on. Gus Van Sant just was reported as doing a show with Kelsey Grammer, an hour drama. And you've obviously got Scorsese doing his thing with Boardwalk Empire and Michael Mann coming to HBO to do the show Luck.
It's where it's happening.
It's kind of telling.
It's where smart people go because, you know, you have to adapt to the longer form, but it's really where you can do your best work now. Mm-hmm. It's not the movies.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why this Amazon thing that was announced this week sort of struck me as, on the one hand, yes, we need experimentation, and they've got the wherewithal, and they can give it a whirl and give it a try. But you're a screenwriter, Chris. I mean, how would you feel if you put your script up on the Amazon site and they owned it for 18 months and anybody could rewrite it if they wanted to? I mean, how would you feel about that?
I haven't heard about this, actually, but it sounds bizarre.
Yeah, no, they've got a first look deal with Warner Brothers.
I see.
And they're trying to set up an alternate kind of open source situation where, you know, like Wikipedia, you know, where you put a script up and you can even put up like a previs or a rough film treatment of a movie and post it and get comments and get reaction and see where there's traction. And the most popular, there's a contest every month and the most popular ones win.
Interesting. Well, that's something to consider for all the screenwriters out there.
By the way, John August has an interesting reaction on his blog.
Oh,
so
I'll have
that's
to check
worth
that out.
Checking. Yeah.
The other thing was Summit's party.
Yes. Okay. So, well, you went to that.
Tuesday.
You were working the room.
I found myself suddenly working the room. See, I'm not the dogged journalist you are at these things, right? So I usually go and just get loaded in a corner. And publicists kind of come up and they're like, hey, do you want to meet so-and-so? I'm like, sure. And there's that moment where they're like, you want to follow me? And I'm like, but I don't kind of jump at the opportunity to follow them to go meet somebody because whatever. And so eventually people just start bringing people to me. That's usually how I function at these things. But I ended up, I guess, in the early parts when I was still rather sober, walking around talking to people. And the first one was Olivia Williams, who was just delightful woman. She's in The Ghost Rider, and obviously people remember her from like Rushmore and things like that. But it's really, you know, this is obviously what publicity behind the film wants to get out there, is the fact that she's so different than the role she's playing here. She's such a funny, not bubbly, but just really funny, precise, affable person. And obviously she's playing a very cold person in the film, and that's seems to be what they think is one of the film's better shots at an Oscar play. So it was great to talk to her. Spoke to the Zuckers, Jerry Zucker and his family. Jerry produced Fair Game. And obviously we talked about Fair Game for a second, and then it was all about comedy and Airplane and Hot Shots and Naked
Gun.
He's
funny. I like him.
Yeah, he's great.
And they did that was a tough call, you know, getting that movie made, and they deserve a lot of credit. And they even deserve a lot of credit for, I don't mean to put it that way. It took guts, I think, actually, to hire Doug Liman
right.
for that movie, because you know that he's going to be a handful.
Yeah.
And he is, from everything I know about him. I still haven't put my interview with him up, one of many interviews that I still have to get prepared for posting.
Mm-hmm.
I love that movie, and I love The Ghost Rider too, but I don't think either of them really has traction in the Oscar race. Do you?
No, not really. I mean, they're noble pursuits, but it's going to be tough. Most of the night I was actually talking to Bryce Howard, who was there with her husband.
Your crush?
Hey. Yes. she was there with her, and I was there with my friend Ryan, you've met, and God, everywhere I take this guy lately, and of course, he's a new father, so he would, but he breaks out his iPhone photos of his daughter, and then it was just all downhill from there, because Bryce has a 3-year-old, and the baby story started flying, and I'm trying to say, hey, loved you in Hereafter, but it just wasn't really, conversation wasn't going there, but it was
your
great.
Your time will come, Chris.
No, it was great. I frankly prefer to talk to people about things that don't have to do with their work or mine, because that's when you get to know real people. So instead of actors kind of putting on a front for publicity, but she's great. It's a great couple. And I can't really put my finger on why they were there. Is she in something that Summit did, or was she just kind of there as part of the guest list, I guess? But Pierce Brosnan was there. Mary Louise Parker was there. Pierce from Ghost Rider, Mary Louise
See,
from
I think
Red.
they should be putting him up for supporting, and they seem to feel, I mean, I'm not quoting anyone here, but I mean, my sense is that they don't think he has a chance, and Olivia Williams does, and I don't quite follow that logic.
It's a tough movie to peg as far as what your best foot to put forward is, I guess. You know, I haven't really dived into the Ghost Rider this year, so I don't really know what the story is on awards potential. I saw the film, I didn't really like it, and I forgot it, so.
Yeah, so while you were working the celebs in the room, I was hanging with Rob Friedman, and that's who I am.
Yeah, it was a long night, too. There was a moment, though, and we should talk about this briefly. They did, and I don't know if you were there when they did this, but they had a brief moment and a toast and a raise a glass to Ronnie Chase, and who was murdered
was
on Monday.
That was very much the subject of that night. I wanted to go to, I had to do a panel that night, a social networking panel at the Egyptian Theater, which was actually very informative. I like doing these panels not so much for what I have to say as for what I can learn from the other people on the panel. Mm-hmm. And I did. It was good. I was also reminded of how funny Chris Gore can be.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not one of your favorite people, but very funny guy. And then I went to... I wanted to go to this thing at the Four Seasons where a lot of friends of Ronnie congregated that night, because that was the night everybody was still reeling,
right?
As I am still, you know. But I couldn't, you know, it was done. It was over. That was why I came to the summit party so late.
Yeah, everybody knew Ronnie, you know. He's been around for years and years and years, and... probably had certainly had a huge hand in forging the publicity business as it is today. And
she represented a kind of old-fashioned school of publicity, and mm-hmm. I mean that in a good way, and I also mean it in a way that very few people did it as well as she did it. In fact, mm-hmm. no one, I would suggest. And it wasn't just that you could see her sort of at a party and know that she was going to come over and, you know, run through her clients with you and mm-hmm. what you could do mm-hmm. and everything, which of course she did. But, and she did it on Saturday night at the Governor's Awards. She came up and kissed me and, you know, did you talk to Hans Zimmer and did you talk to Chris Nolan? And, you know, you know, it was just, you know, she did it in this very, you know, like she's helping you. You know, and she would call and she was relentless and she, you know, but she also understood what your needs were, you know, and she was a lovely
sure.
woman. When I first came into the industry, came to LA really, because I came here from New York, in my late 20s, she, you know, took care of me, you know, taught me stuff. She was very generous and I've stayed friends with her ever since, and I'm just utterly dismayed and distraught at what happened to her.
We exchanged an email or two last week, but the last time I really spent some time with her was in Telluride. We had a dinner together at Telluride with some of the Fox Searchlight publicists, and it was actually one of the first times where I really just got, we weren't even really talking business at all. It was all just kind of drinking, eating, just kind of chatting, and I've always liked her. I liked her even more during that dinner, but you know, she knew April too. Every time she'd come up to some party that April and I were at, when are you two kids getting married? You know, it's just
she was a yenta, you know.
Yeah,
she was good.
I just hope there's some resolve quickly, because I don't want the I don't want there to be a circus of media, as there seems
disturbed.
To be.
Yeah, by the way, that it's an interesting situation, because you have a news story that is playing nationally and, you know, publicist murdered and so forth. And then you have the reaction to the people, you know, from the people in the community. And you know that the people in the community who cared about her and worked with her. And I'm very touched by the fact that others, you know, publicity firms have stepped in to help out, you know, with you know, sort of the needs of her company going forward, and also that the studios are stepping in to pay for the memorial service on Sunday at Hillside at 11 on mm-hmm. Sunday, where there will be an enormous crowd. That's the thing.
Yeah.
You get this sense of how she touched a very large number of people who cared about her. And this
mm-hmm.
is not, you know, normal. It's unusual.
And one of them, obviously, one of our longtime clients being, you mentioned Hans Zimmer. If you're wondering why we led off this podcast with some of the Inception score, Hans was a big passion of Ronnie's this year, and that would be why. So that's my little tip of the hat to Ronnie. She will be missed.
Yes, she will.
Let's close down the shop today with a few reader questions. I'm going to start with kind of a heavy one because it's I thought it was a pretty interesting question. Hopefully it won't put you on the spot too much.
Oh, boy.
Well, it's just one of those things you have to kind of think hard about. It's and back at the decade's worth of films. When you look back at this decade, what do you believe are the films that best reflect the mentality and state of society today? And do these films drastically contrast with the Oscar Best Picture winners of the 2000s? That's Mark R., who asked that. What do you
Is
think?
He asking about this particular year?
Decade. The decade.
The whole decade. Because the first film I think of is No Country for Old Men.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I say that is because it was based on a book, obviously, by Cormac McCarthy, which I read, but both the book and the movie show a portrait of a society that is facing the dark side, and mm-hmm. without necessarily there being a lot of hope for any kind of light.
Right.
And I can't help but feel that that is a movie that shows us what we're facing in many ways and as a world.
That's a very fair point. I'm wrecking my brain. Obviously, I think we'd all agree that Social Network taps into something this year that is of the now and of the zeitgeist.
Definitely.
It's kind of
Definitely.
Running through the past few years of films. And I'm screwing up by looking at the list of Oscar nominees, and maybe this is just answering the question that the Oscars haven't really captured the films that
sometimes the zeitgeist is part of what they when there's a movie like American Beauty
mm-hmm.
that somehow just taps right into where we are now and where mm-hmm. we were then at that moment in 1999, I believe.
Right.
That fuels the movie. That pushes the movie forward because everybody responds and it resonates and it captures a moment in time. I think the Truman Show did that in its day.
Definitely.
Peter Weir's film again back a ways. I think There Will Be Blood is another one that told us something about ourselves, about American, in a way like The Social Network does, you know, what the American business ethic really is or
right,
isn't.
Right. That's true. I think there's shades of this going on in WALL-E actually, just to
very
take
much
it to
so.
Animation.
That's a good example.
And
if you go to docs, I mean, there's no question, which is a different, very different category, but obviously the Inconvenient Truth doc, the Al Gore doc, was a huge deal in mm-hmm. terms of changing the world, mm-hmm. changing the world. It actually did that. And I'd love to see Waiting for Superman and Inside Job have the same impact.
You know, one other film, actually, that I think captured a kind of a state of thought and more of a, in a more vibrant way, and obviously in what it's dealing with parable and metaphor, was The Dark Knight, frankly. Touching on terrorism within the realm of a comic book film, and not to mention ideas of Homeland Security or...
it was a commentary even on the Bush administration at the time.
Yeah, indeed. So that's definitely another... And that's all I can.
And
really
that's
think
one
of
the reasons why The Dark Knight was such a huge hit,
mm-hmm.
but it didn't register as that was before the 10, so it didn't register as a Best Picture contender.
But it was clearly, I guess, a force in the season.
And I think it was close. I believe it was close. That given all the other Guild and Oscar nominations that it did get, that would indicate that it was in the running.
Mm-hmm.
for one of those five slots and would have been in the top 10 if there had been 10.
And speaking of The Dark Knight, the next question pertains to Chris Nolan. People have been bugging me about this all week, so I'm going to address it. I don't think this has been covered at all in other episodes, but I'm curious to know where you and Anne stand on Nolan getting a director nod. I know you're skeptical he's talking about me, but I was looking at the Gurus of Gold chart, and you are one of the very few who aren't predicting him for a Best Picture nod. I hope this topic doesn't sound repetitive, but I'm genuinely curious to hear some discussion on his chances. That's from Kevin K. I have remained skeptical on Chris Nolan getting a director nomination, yes, because, you know, yeah, he's getting a lot of honors lately. The Visual Effects Society just announced that he would get their first ever Visionary Award. He's going to have this big toast at Santa Barbara Fest right in the middle of the awards season. I don't think anyone denies that he's a great filmmaker. Certainly, anyone that's read my reviews of his work knows that I think he's a fantastic filmmaker, even if I don't necessarily lose my shit in the way some other people do about his work. But I think that the director's branch had a chance to nominate him for a film that I think most people think is better than Inception, and they didn't. Now, granted, there was a comic book movie bias going on, but I think that that bias kind of bleeds into a certain kind of genre bias, too, that Inception would be facing just as much. And I also know that there are many Academy members who just didn't like the movie or didn't respond to it. So I'm just remaining cautiously... I'm just remaining cautious. It's not like I don't think the guy has a chance. I'm just not willing to dive into the groupthink that he's definitely going to get a nomination because he's due, or the 10 is a result of The Dark Knight, or whatever. That's where I come down.
I think that what we're looking at now in mid-November is a situation where we can sort of see, granted that we don't have True Grit yet, True Grit being the big unknown, or the James Brooks movie, whatever, but I think given where we are right now, Inception is in the top five of the top 10, and I think Chris Nolan is in the director's group as well. And one of the reasons for that is that of all the films, if you think about it in terms of all the categories of the Academy, all the crafts, all the cinematography, editing, production design, visual effects, makeup, blah, 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 all of that stuff, sound mixing, you know, all that stuff. The movie is the biggest scale movie that's going to end up in the top 10. It is, in fact, the only big scale movie.
Right.
Because The Social Network is really a talking heads movie, as well made as it is, even though it's Fincher. It's not Fincher doing, I mean, he worked on the Internegative and did all sorts of weird, wonky things with it, but it's still not a big visual movie. And, you know, Toy Story 3 is animated. The King's Speech is a nice small period piece. The Kids Are All Right is contemporary and not, you know, that's not about visuals. Winter's Bone is not about visuals. And 127 Hours is pretty frenetic, but it's not, you know, huge. So Inception becomes, by default, the big movie. There is no other. Mm-hmm. I mean, The Way Back ideally would have been a big movie, but that's not how it played out, you know.
Right.
That gives The Way Back a little bit of an edge toward getting in, the fact that it's scale, but it's different scale. It's not about sets. It's not about effects. It's about people walking around in nature, mm-hmm. and the Academy doesn't tend to reward that as much. So I think also to Batman is in fact a sequel. Even, you know, even if it was the whole Dark Knight thing, it's still part of the Batman franchise.
Mm-hmm.
They don't take, there is a bias against that. And I think Inception,
sure,
as an original, as a piece of creation from the ground up, becomes much more powerful, a mm-hmm. competitor in that way. And I think he's gained gravitas. I think people respect Nolan now in a way, mm-hmm. That is very real.
I don't disagree with that. So I guess people are just mistaking not predicting someone for not liking someone. I deal with it every year, though. So,
well, look, I was being reserved about Black Swan, and now I've come around. And that was, I had to see. I just had to see how it was playing and how it was being received. And now I can, you know, as a reporter, I can say, yeah, it's going to happen.
I'm still a bit reserved on that, but we'll save that for another time. That's a good place to stop. We're going long, but and also Inception's a nice place to stop. Since we started with the score, we'll probably just end with the score. So good talk, and we'll chat again next week.
Bye, Chris.
Bye-bye.